thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, number 52, for February the 19th, 2010. What's the buzz? Well, welcome back to the podcast. This is the Snowpocalypse edition of Digital Campus. If you've followed the news at all about the greater Washington metropolitan area, we've had God only knows how much snow in the last few weeks. Schools were closed. Some are still closed. George Mason University even closed. I assume that means the Center for History and New Media even closed for a little bit. But we are back, and we are as good as ever. We're all stronger for all the shoveling. And I'm Mills Kelly, the third of the rotating hosts of Digital Campus, taking the place of Tom Scheinfeld, who took the place of Dan Cohen, who will take the place of me next time. And if you can follow all of that, you are a regular listener. So we're joined today by our regulars, Dan Cohen from dancohen.org.
Hi there, how are you, Dan? Reporting from my igloo.
Reporting from your igloo. Good, yes. Good.
Fairfax, good. Virginia. Yes.
And Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. How's it going, Tom?
Hi, everybody. I'm running on a little bit of lack of sleep. I had snow plows and front end loaders outside. I live right on Wisconsin Avenue in D.C., and they were finally clearing the third lane of traffic with snow with front end loaders all night long right outside our place. So if I'm a little slow on the uptake, or slower on the uptake, I guess, than I usually am, please excuse me.
Okay, we'll make necessary allowances. And then one of our irregulars joins us today, Amanda French, who is at amandafrench.net. How's it going, Amanda?
Going well, Mills, thanks.
And Amanda comes to us from the frozen north of Albany, New York, where they have much less snow than us. This is just one of those freaks of nature, I guess. So today we're turning to a topic that we haven't spent a lot of time on the podcast, but one that's been a lot in the news of late. One could even say there's been a lot of buzz about it, and that is the question of internet privacy. With the launch of Google Buzz several days ago now, one might be willing to ask, does anybody at Google actually have a Facebook page? Because if they do, then they might have noticed that Facebook has gotten several bloody noses over intruding on people's privacy. But perhaps nobody at Google does have a Facebook page, or maybe they just think that they're above all of those kinds of controversies, because there has been a lot of controversy about
Don't they have an Orkut page?
Oh, that's true. I forgot.
With all their friends in Brazil.
That's right.
Very friendly with Brazilians.
Yeah. So what is the controversy about Google Buzz, guys? Is anybody buzzing in Google in their Gmail accounts?
I tried it a bit later, actually, than other people tried it, but I did finally get around to it, and I had a good time playing with it for a couple of days. I figured that I wasn't going to use it anyway, because I'm sort of locked into my social networking habits at this point, and my email habits. I don't like webmail. I prefer to use a client, so I was never going to really be in the Gmail interface as it was, but I did go into it, and it was fun and whatever. And then all the privacy concerns blew up, and I actually spent some time researching exactly what the problem was, and became more and more convinced that, oh yeah, this was actually, this was a problem. Google was making public information that was not public before. And their just tone deafness to that is, I think, really astonishing.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't get it to turn on, and I think, like Tom, I use Google Apps for your domain, which is sort of like having a business account, where I do use Gmail, but it's, you know, I use dan@dancohen.org. And it's just masked through Gmail. And so it didn't automatically turn on for me as it did for others. I sort of found a backdoor to getting into it through Google Reader. And it looks like I'm sort of semi-turned on in Google Reader, because I think, Amanda, you're following me in Google Reader now for some reason. But I'm not following anyone because I couldn't get it to really work since I'm not using the official Gmail account, which would be, you know, an at Gmail. .com. I mean, I guess what this raises, the larger question is, and I think we're going to increasingly find this, and it's really scary, I think, in an academic environment where we start bringing in other resources. But there's a lot of resources combining together on the web, which I guess is the nature of the web, that these kind of overlapping circles of resources and tools and software. And I think what happened here is that we're starting to see is, you know, Google sort of trying to combine different realms in a way that's really clunky and, as Amanda, I think, correctly said, sort of tone deaf. You know, I think just everyone, as soon as it was launched, I mean, I can't believe that this wasn't understood inside. And actually, I think it probably was understood inside the more I think about it. But to think that the social graph of your email is the same as your social graph for Facebook or Twitter is completely insane. And I've got to think that the thousands of PhDs at Google, even if they are lacking in emotional intelligence, as Canaletta claims, I still think at least one or two of them might have considered the fact that, you know, exposing who you email a lot is a bad idea. And that's not the same as the kind of people you follow on Twitter. So it's just a very strange incident here.
Well, I think some of the problem, and Dan, I think you're pointing to this, is some of the problem was they actually didn't test this with anyone. You know, there was, like, strangely for Google, there was no beta test of this project. It was launched as a full-blown product, and you know, all of the testing was done in-house. So people at Google, the 20,000 engineers or however many are employed by Google, have been using Buzz in-house for a while now. And in that respect, so like, and you know, and they're all using Gmail as well. So like, and they're all emailing one another because it's their work email. I mean, in that respect, I could see that it could be really, really interesting. Like, for instance, at CH&M, I could see how it would be great to have all of my colleagues at CH&M on the same kind of Twitter network, on the same, and have that integrated with my email, because I'm spending all day long emailing you, Dan, and emailing Jeremy Boggs, and emailing all these other people at CH&M. And to be able to have a kind of Twitter info update system built into that, in that kind of closed system, could be really interesting. And so I can imagine that the people at Google, when it was closed and it was limited to just the Google employees, said, wow, this is really great. And those, and it was just their work network. And so those in that particular use case, I think the social graphs did map onto one another very well. It's just that when they opened it up to the wider world, you're right, Dan, like the people I email is very, very different from the people, you know, there's some overlap, but very different from the people I'm communicating with on Twitter. So I think some of it was just that the testing regime was just really ill-conceived.
Which is funny, because Google is so well known for, as you say, keeping things in beta for so long and testing things a whole lot. I actually think that some of what I understand of the Google culture does explain this snafu, which is that they were really focused, I think, on interface. So they recognized that it was going to be very useful for people to be in their Gmail interface where they already are and where they're already chatting, and to integrate social networking into that. And I think that all the testing that they did, which was only internal testing, you know, probably had to do with, like, is this a good interface to use, rather than, gee, you know, is your email social graph the same as your public social networking social graph? You know, they didn't think about it in that way. I do think that one of the things this shows is how important social networking is. Google, I think, kind of rushed this product out a little because they're scared of things like Twitter and Facebook. You know, they, I think, recognize that that's where the web is going, you know, that they needed to really get into the social networking space in a much less risible way than they did with Orkut, you know, and I think Buzz was their play for that. And, you know, it didn't really work.
You know, I think I've been trying to put my finger on why I've become increasingly annoyed with Google. And I don't want it to be just a black and white thing where they're a giant tech company and we have to be mad at them just like we were mad at Microsoft in the 1990s and IBM in the 1980s. And it kind of came to me with, even before Buzz, when I started thinking more and more about Google Books, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later in the podcast, but that the reason we grew to love Google was that they were really great, not at creating things themselves on the web, but in organizing decentralized web information, right? I mean, it was search first, but it was other things as well, that they weren't in the business of building centralized services. And they'll probably say, well, Buzz is not a centralized service. We're going to open source it. There'll be APIs, all that stuff. But it just feels like more and more, you know, and Google Books really, I think, is the epitome of this. They're building actually a resource that we go to something.google.com, in this case, buzz.google.com or books.google.com. And it seems like that's their core strength was they had genius computer scientists. They had million server scale network analysis. And they were the place to go when you wanted to get to other stuff or when you wanted to organize other stuff. And I just don't get. I know that they licensed, you know, data from Twitter, and I think they'd like to do the same from Facebook. But maybe it's just that they were getting a brushback from Facebook and couldn't really get in there to organize the Facebook information better than the Facebook folks. But does that make sense to you, Tom? You were saying you agree.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I totally agree with that. I've also, and it's sort of a related thought. I've also been increasingly thinking of, you know, for 10 years now, I've been thinking like Google is this massively innovative company. And I'm starting to realize that actually, I don't think they are that innovative. Like, I think they've done search better than anybody else has done it, but they didn't invent search. I think they've done, you know, I think Gmail is great. I think they've done webmail better than anybody else has done it, but they didn't invent webmail. They've done, you know, online sharing of documents and collaborative documents sort of better than anybody else has, but like they didn't invent that either. And they, you know, they're trying to do social networking, and maybe they'll do it better than Facebook, but you know, who knows? I just think Google, it seems to me, has had sort of this one really, you know, like hit it out of the park home run in they've done search better than anybody else has done it. And they've had really one, I think, major innovation, which is a business model innovation in advertising. But aside from that, I feel
which they basically took from Overture.
True, right? True. And it just seems to me that at this point, so if we point to, let's say we point to search and ads as like the Google, the real revolutionary thing that Google did, I feel like all this other stuff is, you know, it's sort of the cart starting to come before the horse. And I think you're right. I think they've made this shift to being a kind of destination when before they were a service, and that it puts Google in a whole new light for me. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see where Google goes, you know, in sort of the second decade of its life.
Well, and I think it's in that sense it sort of mirrors a lot of what we saw in the 1990s is e-businesses that then started building bricks and mortar stores, and most of those didn't work out very well. And so it'll be interesting to see whether Google can make some of this transition to the equivalent of a bricks and mortar operation for certain things. And certainly, you know, if they build this vast digital library that they've been working on, and it becomes a competitor in some way to Amazon or other kinds of library services, then they'll be judged by a different metric than they're judged now. I want to go back for just a second to something that Dan said, because one of the things we've talked about a lot on the podcast is universities moving increasingly to cloud-based services for email and just about anything, and instead of paying for these proprietary email systems that are generally pretty bad. What do we think about that? Is this if universities really are moving in that direction, this kind of aggregation of information that Dan was talking about a minute ago, is that going to be a problem for our campuses?
Well, I think one thing that Google did that they were very smart about with the launch of Buzz was that they didn't they didn't apply Buzz to Google Apps for My Domain. So all of those students who are on university campuses that have switched to Gmail, and all of those businesses that are using Google Apps for My Domain, those people weren't automatically added to Buzz, and all of those contacts weren't automatically exposed. It was just people using the consumer service, Gmail, not the webmail for Google Apps for My Domain. And I mean, it would have been a much, much bigger deal had they, you know, all of a sudden exposed all of the contacts and all of the email addresses for everybody on, let's say, the Boston College campus or the USC campus or these other institutions that are using these services. If it's just, you know, a person here and a person there and a person there, they can make a lot of noise. But if you do that with a big institution, you end up in a lot of trouble. So I think in that respect, they were kind of smart, and which actually starts to make me think that, I'm not sure whether Dan or Amanda said this, but they had thought about this initially. This wasn't something that, you know, this wasn't just a goof. They had this was maybe more planned than they let on.
Well, Tom, I mean, that kind of scenario that you're describing is almost like you have to pay for privacy. You know, if you get a service like Gmail for free, just as an individual consumer, well, then implicitly the transaction is Google has the right to use your data to, you know, show you ads or that kind of thing. Whereas if you're paying for Google services on the enterprise level, well, there's an implicit agreement in that Google is not going to expose your data willy-nilly the way it did for individuals.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I mean, because the value proposition for Google of those two different services, the Gmail versus the Google Apps for My Domain, are totally different, right? I mean, they're getting, you know, I have a paid account for Google Apps for My Domain, so I don't have to see the ads because ad blocker doesn't work on Google Apps for My Domain. I pay $50 a year for this service, and my contacts weren't exposed. It makes sense, though, for Google to expose the contacts. I mean, right? Like, Google's whole business model is, you know, putting more information out there, getting people to expose more of their web pages, their information. And so the value proposition for Gmail is, I mean, it needs to be more public. It's not good for Google to have all those databases locked down and private. They need to be public in some way for Google to make money on them, because they need to put ads on them. So you're absolutely, I think you're totally right. Like, it was a value proposition there, that they, a decision that they made.
Well, Tom, I wanted to go back to your point, actually, because I disagree a little bit that Google didn't innovate much. I mean, I think they did. I think innovation in general isn't necessarily about being purely original. You know, it's about taking things and adding that one little twist that makes them really useful. But I do think that you're absolutely right that Google seems to be changing as a company, that they do seem to be focusing more on building things and becoming a destination and that kind of thing, rather than just organizing information. And, you know, you have things like the fact that Google has a phone, you know, the Nexus One. I mean, even last year, there are people who said, hey, Google's never going to get into the business of, you know, building a phone or building a phone operating system. You know, why would they do that? What does that have to do with organizing information? And I think that that's in some ways not going very well, you know, this whole Nexus One kerfuffle, you know. So Google is, it seems to me like if you think of Google as a person, as a character, it's kind of transitioning from being, they used to have a kind of an academic personality, you know. They were run by Larry and Sergey, who were engineering PhD students, and they had all these kind of idealistic things that they would say about what Google's mission was, but they just seem to be turning more and more into the kind of business that we academics all love to hate, where they're, you know, they're playing catch up with other companies, and it seems to be all about the competition, all about, you know, social networking is where it's at. Let's do social networking, and mobile phones is where it's at. Let's do that. You know, so.
And you see that Larry and Sergey have in fact announced a plan for selling, you know, their majority stake in the company and for,
right,
and for basically getting out. And so, you know, even just structurally, it is becoming more of an ordinary private publicly traded corporation. So,
yeah, and you know, now they've announced that they're going to start experimenting with providing broadband access in selected markets. Another sort of bricks and mortar strategy.
Mm-hmm. You know, what I worry about going forward, just back to Mills, your original point on privacy, is that I think what happened, and, you know, I've grown to love Twitter, but I think Twitter is having this influence that Twitter start from the start was, it's all public. This is a public stream of information. And I think what's happening now is, even though Twitter really hasn't been, you know, in the big scheme of things, a success like Facebook or Google, I think a lot of the tech people, because they hang out a lot on Twitter, feel like this is the future of this open information. And Facebook, a lot of its clumsiness surrounding privacy, and now Google, a lot of its clumsiness surrounding privacy, has to do with them really wanting to get as much information as possible into a public data stream that then can be mined and used in other ways. And so Facebook is, you know, in this latest update where they basically had the default be that all your updates were public to everyone, you know, was trying to kind of Twitterize itself. Google, I think, with Buzz was sort of trying to Twitterize itself. And, you know, I've been playing around a lot with Google Books with the My Library function, which is used by me and maybe one other person in the entire world. But if you go to books.google.com and you have a Google account, they're really pushing it now. And what's really interesting about this, which I think is very unusual for the book world versus, let's say, the Twitter world, is if you save books to your library, the default is that they're public. They start you out with a bunch of public folders. And I had to really look around to find a way to create a private folder that has a little lock next to it. They're called bookshelves. So if you favorite something or if you're reading something, there's a Reading Now folder or a Have Read folder or a Reviewed folder. Those are all public folders. And, you know, you think about the future here of where Google Books is going to be licensed to universities if, well, we can talk about settlement in a minute, but maybe it won't be licensed to universities. But in at least in the hypothetical, if for universities like Mason, where we only have a 1 million volume library and we want to get access to another 10 million volumes, and the university licenses Google Books to get access to those, and that my library features turn on, you know, we're going to have a lot of people finding out that what they're reading is public, that all the defaults now are going to be for public sharing.
Right. And it's so funny because that's information that librarians, you know, have a deep cultural principle about not sharing, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
They want to protect their users' data, you know, like what you are reading should be private data. Well, funny story about that, Dan. The class I was teaching last fall, I assigned my students to make, you know, I made them sign up for Zotero and make Zotero libraries, and then I was going to grade them. And as I was grading them, I realized that they were all private by default, so I couldn't see them. I was like, whoops, I'm sorry, I have to go in and make Zotero libraries public so that I can see them, you know. And it was kind of funny because I assumed that they would be public by default. And I have to say that that's kind of my approach to the web. I mean, even email, I kind of assume that it's going to be public. But but I don't think that that's what everybody does or what everybody should have to do.
Right. I mean, but can you imagine the associations, if they had flipped on Buzz, which it looks like they've sort of done, or they flipped on this social feature to Google Reader this week, which clearly is going to hook into the whole social framework, I guess, or setting up that Buzz is one part of. But can you imagine if they flipped that on in Google Books and all of a sudden, you know, you could see that whatever, someone was following, you know, was reading Karl Marx for a class, and so, you know, had taken out Karl Marx into their library, and then instantly was associated with, you know, the Communist Party of America, and, you know, their parents log on, and, you know, it just, the potential for havoc here is really increasing.
Well, in particular, you know, finding out that Dan Cohen was a major fan of Harlequin romances was a shock to me, so... It was, but now I know what to get you for your next birthday.
I'm going to fill my iPad with Harlequin romances.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the sort of counter arguments to the things that we've been talking about is but if you're not doing anything wrong, why do you worry about this?
I hate that argument. Although, as I say, it's kind of the way that I conduct myself online. You know, I feel like I try to be squeaky clean. You know, I actually do cuss. I say bad words, like in private, in real life, but I don't on the internet, you know, and I won't now, you know. I think it's the inappropriate.
It's a family podcast, yeah.
That's right. But, you know, I don't like that argument at all. And of course, Eric Schmidt has been quoted saying that kind of thing, and so is Mark Zuckerberg. And it's, you cannot impose that on other people.
But so now this turn, I'd like to turn for just a minute to another story that was in the news about privacy. And this was a case of a high school student who was disciplined for saying bad things on a Facebook page about an administrator at a school that the student attended.
Speaking of cussing.
Yeah.
And so, speaking of wanting to cuss right now.
Yeah. So, I mean, what do you guys think about this? Is this too far? Disciplining a student in this way?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely too far. I mean, the student says and says out of school. I can't see how that should be disciplined by the school. But I think it also shows that on these, you know, in these more complex systems, the more feature rich the system, the more difficult it is for the users to kind of understand what is private and what isn't. You know, I'm sure this student sort of thought that like, this is never going to get back to the administrator. But it's very difficult on a system like Facebook. I mean, the privacy settings are, I mean, you really have to like, there's like 100 of them, and you have to really think very carefully about, you know, which things you're going to make private, how private, which groups of people can see what. You know, I mean, it would take like a study and a lot of time to like customize your privacy settings for something as feature rich as Facebook, to really be what you want it to be. And so, I mean, I think that's part of the problem, is that like people don't really know what the things that they're doing, which ones are private and which ones aren't. And so a student, you know, goes on and thinks he's talking to his friends. And in fact, he's not talking to his friends. He's talking to the principal. And that I think is a big problem with all these more complex systems, which sort of sets them apart from Twitter, which the privacy settings on Twitter are very simple because the system is very simple.
But you know, corporations fire employees all the time for writing things in blogs or, you know, on Facebook or Twitter, you know, criticizing their employer. So should students get a pass just because they're students?
Well, I guess the function of the corporation is different than the function of the school, I guess is what I would say. That you know, you're the principal, the administration of the school is there to serve the students, not the other way around. Whereas in a corporation, I mean, the employees are there to serve the owner, the shareholders, whoever it is, and they serve at the pleasure of those people. School is, I think, a little different in that way. I mean, that's I haven't thought this through, but it just seems to me that, you know, the altruistic or the social mission of school changes those relationships.
Well, sure. Students are required to go to school, and they, you know, usually don't have too much choice about which public school they, you know, are going to go to. So they've got to be there, and they've got to be subject to rules that we would hope would be reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that it's a free speech problem. I'm just trying to be a little provocative about this because, as a parent of now a middle schooler who spends a fair amount of time on Facebook, you know, there's a certain amount of it that is just teenage 13, 14 year old behavior, and then, you know, some of it can start, you know, crossing over into inappropriate. And I think in this particular case of the school administrator going after the student for posting something on Facebook, that seems like a real overreach to me. But at the same time, I think young people can learn some useful life lessons about exactly what Tom said, the need to develop a fairly complex set of skills when it comes to monitoring their Facebook settings, for instance.
Actually, what I found kind of interesting about that story was that the student seemed to be reasonably sophisticated already about what she could and couldn't say. I mean, she created a page, like the opposite of a fan page, I guess, you know, a page that this teacher is the worst teacher I've ever had. And what was interesting is that in the judgment, they said, look, this page was not libelous. It wasn't threatening in any way. It almost sounded to me like she had some kind of instinctive sense of what would be okay and not okay in terms of free speech. And it looked to me like it was absolutely, you know, perfectly valid criticism, you know, the kind of thing that you would write in a course evaluation. if you had that.
But I guess there's an issue here, and I think it's an issue that's not unique to the internet. And it's, you know, there is a difference between what is legal and what is proper and what is and what is good for you. You know, like, you know, it's legal for me to say whatever I want on Twitter. It's not good for my career to say certain things. And so I try not to say those things. I think teaching students those skills, and I think it certainly extends into the college years and even into the graduate student years, teaching our graduate students and even junior faculty, you know, what are the norms of these communities? What is meant to be kept private and what is meant to be made public? You know, I think those kinds of issues are. And that kind of mentoring is more important now than ever, since it's so easy to be public.
Well, and then to take this one step further, probably the scariest story appeared on Boing Boing today or yes, 2 days ago about a school district in Pennsylvania that had given laptops to their students with software in the laptop that allowed the schools to turn on the webcam in the laptop remotely and monitor the students' behavior. And this, and a child was disciplined for, according to the story, improper behavior in his home. Using in the evidence for this was the vice principal took a photo of the student through the webcam as evidence. It seems to me this is
without the student's knowledge.
Without the student's knowledge, absolutely nobody until the student was disciplined. No one in the school district, other than the administrators, knew that it was possible for administrators to turn on the webcams remotely. And this, I think, crosses over into the creepy, as opposed to and I think probably also very illegal, because these are minors and most of them, and they're being photographed by. Without their knowledge, by adults, not their parents.
I almost can't believe this. I mean, this is like you can't make it up, you know, when you're learning about writing fiction and they say, you know, that truth is stranger than fiction. You actually have to write something that makes sense. This just almost doesn't make sense to me that this could happen.
In the story, it says the school district admits that student laptops were shipped with software.
Right. No, I mean, I think what's happening here is that people are starting as people get more savvy with this technology. I think as in a, you know, in a school environment, there's just going to be an arms race. I mean, there's going to be an arms race around GPS devices for students. You know, I can absolutely imagine there's going to be an arms race in terms of privacy and monitoring around e-readers. So let's say a school district gets a bunch of iPads or Kindles, you know, I'm sure it will be easy to find out. Did a student actually leaf through the entirety of a book or look at a textbook on this device? All these things that you couldn't do in an analog world. And, you know, Mills, you mentioned you have a middle school age child. I have a middle school age nephew who is very technically sophisticated, and he and his friends set up their own website so that they could have kind of back channel communications. I mean, they actually got a domain name. They set up a forum software, and this was all to have a kind of back channel conversation about classes or Dungeons and Dragons or whatever else they wanted to discuss. I assume it will be shortly girls. But, you know, and I just think there's going to be this kind of cat and mouse game, but the temptation will be so much more there. And again, this feeds back into our initial discussion in that, you know, if the corporate world is moving toward, let's get as much of this public as possible, let's make the default all be public airing of your information, then there's going to be even more chance for administrators or parents or other monitoring services to kind of connect the dots. So look at your Google Books shelf and your Facebook profile and all these things. I mean, it's rather frightening.
Well, and the New York Times had a story today about a cell phone monitoring study. They weren't monitoring individuals, but using data about calls placed through individual towers to track the movements of about 100,000 people in Europe, and found that we're actually pretty boring because we 92% of the time we follow pretty predetermined routines. But again, it raises the same issue of GPS enabled phones being able to, you can follow the movement of people by the movement of their phones. And so I think it really is going to be an issue that's going to play out in the public sphere a lot over the next couple of years, because if this Lower Merion, Pennsylvania school district is any indication, there are lots of people who are willing to cross some pretty obvious lines to gather data for whatever purpose. And so purposes which I think they felt were very legitimate purposes, and I think it was just a boneheaded decision on their part. But so I think this is something we're going to see a lot more of. Turning now away from privacy to the other big story that we talked about in the last podcast, which was the appearance of the iPad at an Apple event. One of the things we've all talked about since then is that the appearance of the iPad, if it does nothing else, it's going to ratchet up the quality of ebook readers. Amanda, you've spent a lot of time in the library world. What do you think the improving quality of ebook readers is going to mean for libraries?
Well, it's not clear yet. And it's not clear to me that iPad, to be honest, is going to improve the ebook reader experience that much yet. It may well, but it may not. I do think that not only libraries, but universities in general, there have been some universities that do ebook reader studies in the classroom. And I mean, I think even still, there's no real sense that ebook readers are going to improve learning. And there's no real sense that students are chomping at the bit for ebooks, with two exceptions. People are always a little interested in not having a lot of books to carry around, and people are always, you know, students are always interested in getting their text cheaper. So I think that actually an improved experience of ebook reading is not at the top of most students' lists. And again, the other thing about things like the iPad is that it doesn't matter how beautiful the text looks. Like they had that demonstration with the iPad where you can turn a page, you know, with a swipe of your finger. Ooh, you know, that kind of thing is not a legitimately improved experience for most people. That's just, you know, oohs and ahs. People actually really want, particularly in the educational sphere, a way to take notes, save them, search them, you know, export them to other formats. And again, it's not at all quite clear to me that the iPad is going to do that, although I believe the iPad is going to support the open EPUB format, if I'm not mistaken. You know, I don't know. It's all still really up in the air. And to be honest, I'm not sure that iPad is going to change that much. But it is true that ebooks are, you know, becoming more and more important and of interest to all kinds of people.
Well, but it seems to me from the standpoint of the library business, the main attraction is storage of books and the preservation of books, that it could potentially significantly reduce those overhead costs in this direction.
And there were a couple of studies that came out really recently suggesting that. I see that maybe libraries might jump on this bandwagon, and I think that they would be a little wrong to do so. I'm not actually convinced that, despite these studies, perhaps irrationally, that the cost of keeping bound books on the shelves is that much greater than the ultimate long-term cost of investing in ebooks. There's always a lot of infrastructure that goes into supporting any digital format or any digital project. You know, there's skilled, you know, hiring programmers who can make a lot more money elsewhere. You know, that sort of,
and to some extent,
your digital repository. You know.
To some extent, I mean, it's also, excuse me, it's also shifting the costs of the library onto the users. I mean, yes, it costs the library a lot of money to maintain these collections of books, and it will cost them less to acquire and maintain copies of ebooks. But that then requires the user to have a new ebook reader every 2 or 3 years, in the way that the user has a new laptop every 2 or 3 years. Or the, you know, you need, who's using the cell phone they used 5 years ago? So
me.
Like everybody, well, Mills, you're
I'm the last dinosaur.
You're the last. Is that like a StarTAC flip phone, or what were we using 5 years ago? I think
it's
I probably
the brick with antenna, isn't it?
My son,
it's what
my son tells
what
me
Magnum PI used.
My son tells me I'm not allowed to take my cell phone out of my pocket in the presence of his friends. It's too humiliating.
But so like the cost then of the library then just gets shifted to the patron, where the patron now is like all of, you know, maintaining the hardware and maintaining the software and updating the hardware and the software. I mean, that all then falls on the patron and the student and the faculty member. So I don't know, if the total, maintaining technology infrastructure is not cheap. And so this may shift the cost away from the library, but I'm not sure it saves money, as you say, Amanda, in the long term. I'll add one more thing about this. The entire discussion, it seems to me, or most of the discussion about ebook readers to this point has been about how it changes books. Right, how it changes the book market, how it changes how books are stored, distributed, shelved, used in the classroom, paid for, all of those things. What we haven't seen, and what there's been a lot less discussion about, and I think legitimately, because I don't think we know this, the answer to this question yet, is how ebook readers will change reading. Right. And I think that's actually the much more interesting question. It's like, how do these devices and these new distribution methods and these new technologies, how do they change reading? Not so much how they change books, but are we going to read differently? And what does that mean for knowledge creation and knowledge dissemination and learning and all of the things that are associated with those things? So that I think really remains to be seen. So while we can, you know, have these discussions about, you know, business models and costs and all those things, and which are interesting, I don't think we know, you know, the answer to the real question, and we probably won't for another several years.
That's interesting, because I think that this is all my own personal sense, but I feel like reading has already changed, in that people are less likely to read books and long form things. I feel like my own reading has become more fragmented. And honestly, I think that's a good thing. I feel like I'm acquiring a lot more information faster. But that's why I'm all in favor of, you know, reading digitally and digitizing information, digitizing articles, writing blog posts, you know, digitizing books, all of that kind of thing. But that doesn't translate for me into being really rah-rah about the ebook, which seems to me to be a completely different beast, you know, like a thing that you read on a digital reader separately, like people trying to translate the book into a digital format for long-term, you know, long-form reading. I just don't think that people are there yet. And the reason, I don't know why people do these long studies if they can't convince people, but the studies that are about to be published by the Council on Library and Information Resources suggesting that ebooks will save the libraries a lot of money, I don't quite believe them, because that strikes me as a really convenient argument for libraries. Libraries want to do a lot more stuff with digital material, and they want to have control over that. And I think they recognize that one of the most powerful arguments is going to be the economic argument. If you can argue that digital is cheaper, people are more likely to give you money to do things that are digital, you know, when in fact, maybe what you just want to do is, you know, see what happens, explore it, you know, play with it, and not have to justify it up front with that kind of thing. That's what I want to do. I want to just go digital just for the heck of it.
You know, I've actually been reading a few ebooks lately. I did read Adrian John's book on piracy, which is terrific, and I highly recommend it. When Chicago had their University of Chicago has this monthly, you know, get a free ebook, and I've also been downloading some books from our local Fairfax library. They have an online program, and you know, one of the things I do worry
about. What
are
you reading them on, Dan? Are you reading them on your laptop?
On a laptop, yeah. Yeah, well,
Adobe Digital Edition software.
Let me tell you the rest of the story on this, and why I think it's just, you know, I agree about you know, getting past technology into what does it do to reading to have it be an ebook. But, you know, one thing I did realize is the Chicago book, to read it, required me to get an account with Adobe, what's called an Adobe ID, to read this book. Which, first of all, just offended me on that, if anyone from UChicago Press is listening. I mean, to have that be a requirement of reading an ebook, because, of course, it's DRM'd. It's got digital rights management on it, and which is another issue entirely. But the fact that the ID has to go to Adobe, and then they know what you're reading because they have to authorize the book before you can read it in their special software that I had to download. So that was one experience that kind of creeped me out. And then you wonder about, you know, Steve Jobs is on the warpath trying to get rid of Flash on the iPad. I mean, what if this software goes away, which it will in 5 or 10 years? You know, how does a library anticipate these things unless there's unless we all standardize on an open non-DRM format like EPUB, which is basically just an easy to read XML format, you know, HTML, CSS-ish kind of format. We're going to have these sort of generations of, you know, upgrading the technology. The end of the story is from our local library, they required me to install a bunch of software, which I did. And then I started downloading some things. And then I just couldn't get them to open at all. And I tried downloading an audiobook for my kids. That also didn't work. And then I went back, looked through all the frequently asked questions. Finally, at the bottom, it said, you can't use this on a Mac because the DRM is linked to Windows DRM. Mm. So, you know, there's going to be these technical environments that just prevent you from getting to the reading itself, or that are going to change over time. And I also noticed that when I went to, they then had a subsection that were just MP3s. So in other words, open, or more or less open, you know, can play on anything files for the audiobooks. And then they did have some EPUBs, and the EPUBs were like, you know, self-published, you know, My Theory of the Universe books that, you know, someone had probably published for free in EPUB, or self-help books. And so, you know, I couldn't get to the actual good nonfiction that I wanted to get because all those were DRM'd. So I think this technical environment is rather important. And I worry about, I mean, particularly on this, the University Press side, I mean, if University Presses are going to go with, you know, choose a Adobe DRM, I can't remember what it's called, ACS4 or something. We're going to run into these situations more and more. And I pity the library directors who have to kind of make purchasing decisions on, you know, what digital environment they're going to subscribe to. Or, you know, at least a book, it sits on the shelf. You can always access it.
Well,
yeah, that's my rant. That's my rant.
Speaking as a university administrator, I have to say this whole discussion has been highly unsettling to me, because I've lived my whole life assuming that if it was digital, it was virtually free. And now I'm going to have to rethink my entire budget allocation strategy for the university. Like, I get to allocate any budget. But it is, you know, this does raise some really serious issues for our campuses, because I do think that there is an assumption that if it's digital, it must be cheaper. And that comes into play on an awful lot of campuses. And, you know, we've ranted about this a number of times on the podcast, but it is something that increasingly our administrators are going to have to face. Well, I think we've reached the end of our discussion on this, and I just want to say for the regular listeners and for my co-participants in the podcast today, I have to tell you why it is that when I tried Google Buzz, I recoiled in horror and had to immediately unconnect myself, and that is I started seeing things that looked like Twitter feeds showing up on my Google account, and this frightened me that somehow Google had tricked me into joining Twitter, and so I had to immediately disconnect from the whole system.
Oh my gosh, you're unclean now.
I know. I feel sullied.
You were
in
like
some way.
The angel of this podcast, unsoiled.
Not only that, but they published the fact that you're actually a Harlequin book author and have been emailing Harlequin frequently.
I am not embarrassed to be the author of many Harlequin romances, because you should see the Bentley that I drive to work every day. This is a highly profitable endeavor of mine, but I will not tell you what my pseudonym is. You'll just have to guess. So thanks to everybody.
Is it Kelly Mills?
No, that would actually be my cousin Kelly Mills, who is a photographer in Atlanta. And if you want to know the whole story behind the naming conventions in my family, you'll have to listen to another edition of Digital Campus.
Just look for any romance set in Slovakia and you'll know it's
that's
MILFs.
Right. That's right. And well, Slovak men are known for their large pectoral muscles and long hair. So anyway, thank you all very much for listening to another edition of Digital Campus. Thanks, Amanda, for joining us again as one of our irregulars. And we'll see you the next time you sign on and listen to the podcast.
Thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.